You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hi, I'm Bunny Guinness, and this is my podcast, Bunny in the Garden, with someone special. Someone who is well known for something other than their green fingers, but who is also a mustard-keen gardener. I'll discover them through their garden, why, how, and when they garden, the best tips they've learned, and their gardening style and approach. I'm in the calming oasis of Rachel Johnson's small London garden. Rachel is a well-known journalist, television presenter, columnist and author. She frequently is on political discussion panels, mainly for Sky and the BBC. Rachel participated in Celebrity Big Brother, and she, like two of her brothers and her father, attempted to go into politics. Mm-hmm. She was the lead candidate for Change UK for the South West England constituency in 2019 European parliamentary election. What you might not know is she is a crack tennis player, was on the garden committee for her house in Notting Hill, and is married to Ivo Dorney, who was a director consultant to the National Trust. And Ivo will be joining us shortly. Rachel, it's so lovely to be here. And it's so nice. Having just done your podcast, I feel like now you're in the chair and it's your turn.
It's our return match.
Return match, yes. So I was amazed that you were let into Ashdown House, which until you came along was then an all-boys prep school. It was a feeder for Eton, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a feeder for Eton.
And I was so impressed that Stanley, your dad, managed to get a space for you there, because it was quite a coup to get you in.
Well, I don't know about that, but I mean, he just bullied the headmaster. Stanley is a very forceful man. And when it was arranged that my older brother, Alexander Boris, would be going to Ashdown House aged 11. The headmaster said, are there any other siblings? And Stanley said, yes, there are three more after Alexander Boris, although he really was just called Alexander then. And Clive Williams, the headmaster, then said, oh, good, we'll have all of them. And so my father nipped in with, great, Rachel will be starting in September then. And he went, Stanley, I'm afraid we don't take girls because they're already on first name terms, you know, man to man. And my father said, well, you do now. And so I went as the first equal girl boarder to Ashdown House, Forest Row, East Grinstead, Sussex in 1976.
Oh, wow.
1975?
Yeah, because I remember there's a school, a local school near us, and it was difficult to get into. And so one parent actually dressed her child up, didn't have a place, in the school uniform, and sent her in on the first day of tour, not having a place. And she got in like that.
That's such a good trick.
Yeah.
Good hack.
Yes.
How to get your child into Eton. Go to New and Lingwood, buy a tailcoat. Send them to whatever it's called.
I'm amazed that Stanley didn't do that for Eton for you. Did he not try and get you into Eton?
There were girls at Eton, but they were daughters of Beaks.
Yes.
Yeah.
So he didn't try that for you.
And I wasn't the daughter of a Beak.
And he didn't try to get you in.
I think if he had occurred to him, he might have done. I would have loved to have gone to Eton.
Seriously?
I was very disappointed with my school days, yeah.
Oh, really? And at Ashdown, I remember my husband went there and, you know, he actually quite liked it, but they were beaten if they got a word wrong in Latin verse, and they never did science. It was extraordinary school. Maybe in your day they did, because you obviously
we
much
did
younger.
Do science.
Oh right,
I love you saying obviously. We did do science of a kind of, you know, Bunsen burner type science lesson once or twice a week.
Yes,
and there was beating, and I think I contributed to the the abolition of beating at Ashdown, because I'd been roaming around the corridors at night with, you know, some of the boys from another dorm.
Gosh.
Trying to raid the tuck cupboard.
Right.
And we got caught, and we were offered a choice of whether we would be beaten or whether we'd miss the Exeat weekend. And my parents lived in Brussels, and I hadn't seen them for 6 weeks already. So I said, well, yes, I definitely want to be beaten, please, sir. And the Clive Williams kind of looked a bit grey, and he thought, how can I beat her? It's just kind of, it's a bit odd. It's all right walloping a boy with a cricket bat, but a girl.
Really?
And,
really? I remember sexual discrimination.
I know. So I remember sitting.
And he preferred boys. Well, sorry. Yes.
I remember having to sit in top form and do a Latin grammar paper as my punishment instead of being beaten or not seeing my parents. And Clive then said that that's when he stopped caning or beating the pupils. But my younger brother, Joe, who's 6 years younger than me, says it wasn't true. He didn't stop beating the boys because he was beaten profusely afterwards. So I'm not sure. We need to verify that, my anecdote, is all I'm saying,
right,
Bunny.
Right, okay, you don't know if it actually stopped or not. So, yeah, I would have gone for the beating, I think. I do, but the boys, you always hear stories of them having wallets in their back pockets and things, but it's more difficult as a girl, isn't it?
I don't remember being beaten.
Right.
I mean, I think I sort of avoided it, although I did quite a lot to provoke it.
And so you were quite a tender age when you were sent. How old were you?
I was just 10, I think.
Oh, so a little bit older than 6 or 7 or so then, yes. And did you find it tough because your mother wasn't so well? Is that right? She had a nervous breakdown at the time, which is what led to you and Boris going away. So was it, I always think when you're sent away from home, when something's happened at home, you feel like it's not right? Or didn't you register that something was wrong?
That's a good question. I didn't. I mean, I just thought, well, my Al has gone, Alexander's gone. Well, then I'll go next. And then Leo went, and then Joe went, but only after, he went to a day school first. But it just was, you know, it was one of those things, you accept what happens to you as a child. I mean, there was quite a lot going on, you know, in the family. We were living in Brussels in the 70s, and it was all very... I don't know if you've seen a film called The Ice Storm.
No.
But it's a fantastic novel by Rick Moody about adultery in Connecticut. it's unlikely, but it's true, which was turned into a fantastic film.
Yeah.
With, I think, Kevin Klein. I can't remember who else, but I highly recommend it to all your viewers and listeners, Pop Bunny. No, it was all very like that, of sort of consciousness raising and open marriages and everything. Key parties, but I'm not saying my parents did any of that, but that was the vibe of the 70s.
Yeah, definitely. I remember
and actually
that.
Going
yeah.
to boarding school, however, you know, however problematic that prep school turned out to be in the end, I liked the fact that you knew what you were doing at every hour of every day. I liked the fact there were rules, structures and boundaries.
That's interesting, because that's exactly what my husband said about it. For him, it was a haven, because at home, with an alcoholic mother, no father, no meals, nothing, you know, it was all very floating. And there, he knew he was going to get fed on time, and things happened according to a plan.
Yeah.
And for him, as a child, that was so reassuring.
I think children really do benefit from structure and routine and boundaries, and it's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
I mean, as an adult, it's... You know, we know how much work that involves.
Yes.
You know, having a bedtime, having, you know, rules at meal times about sitting and eating properly and all those things and not jumping up. And, you know, it's really hard, but you do learn that. We had a Norland nanny, a probationer, you know, so she was very young when we lived in Brussels, and she was also wonderful. I'd like to shout out to Mary Kidd, who's still a family friend.
Oh, lovely.
And she kind of came in, and she brought some of that whole Norland college training into the house. Because, you know, I had two wonderful parents. My father's still alive. I mean, super creative and funny people. Exuberant. I mean, overflowing with life and creativity and drive and energy. And, you know, what you need, what sometimes what children need is very down to earth, kind of quite prosaic, nanny in the nursery type people as well. And so we had that for a time. So I will always be grateful for to nanny kid for the time she spent with us.
Interesting. And I always think that having an older brother and two younger brothers, but then going to an all-boys prep school, it must have been very active, very, I always think, competitive. You know, you're given this if you come top of the class and this. Did you find it a highly competitive hothouse? Because it was an academic school, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a ridiculously competitive person. I mean, I turn everything into a competition. I mean, I remember, and so does my family.
All of you, you're all like that, without exception.
I remember once we had a who can eat the mince pies fastest competition, and my brother burnt his mouth terribly badly. I mean, yeah, who can do this fastest? Who can climb the tree highest? Who can run fastest? Who can sell the most books? Who can, you know, come top more often? I mean, this is what essentially drove, I think, my brother to become prime minister, was, you know, you had to be top. And what's the top job in politics?
But as the girl in the running and the racing, with the brothers, surely they beat the hell out of you.
Not at all.
Really?
Who have you been talking to?
Seriously? You can beat them at sports?
I can run faster than some of them, and I can beat some of them at tennis, yeah.
Oh, that's good. That's really good.
I can't
say
I can beat them in a what do you call it, a hand wrestling match or a fight. But... you know, we're all too old now for that sort of thing, Bonnie.
Really?
Well, I say that.
But, so, I mean, all of you seem to have drive, don't you? You all seem to have high energy values and competitive. And those are the things, the four of you really spurring each other on, and your parents as well, your father particularly. Never saying no to anything.
Yeah, I wish I did learn how to say no to things, but... for example, I'm in a TV series called Celebrity SAS. Well, I don't know when this is coming out, but which starts September the 22nd on Channel 4, where I abseil, I dive. And
you've done it all now, I've recorded it all.
Yeah, it's coming out
on
September the 22nd. I can't reveal that. I'm NDA'd.
But you get thrown out week by week type thing.
Yeah.
So and what does the winner win?
No, you just... No, selection to the SAS.
Oh, absolutely. That's a new career.
Right. Honestly, yeah. I mean, I quite enjoyed it. It was certainly more fun than Celebrity Big Brother.
So with all these celebrity things, I was interested to hear someone who did Strictly recently told me that they got the same amount whether they were knocked out in first week or the
so
end.
Stupid,
are they all like that?
Yeah, you should be given an incentive to carry on.
But don't
otherwise,
they?
Why would I mean? I don't need to be on television any more than I have to be. So
now,
I
come
think,
on, now that itself is contradiction. I don't have to be any more than
I don't
need to be any more than I have to be.
I did it for the experience and for the check. I didn't do it so I could be on television.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
So,
you say that, but. You do gain a lot from these things, don't you? You learn. You meet all these different people, which I think in a way that you would never rub across them otherwise, rub up against them in quite an intimate way. So it must be a fascinating experience.
I know. I really enjoyed it. And also it was filmed in New Zealand and it was epically beautiful and absorbing and scary and fun.
Oh, lovely.
Well, especially now it's over.
So there were moments when you thought, what have I done? Signing up. You never got that feeling.
I think the first day was the one where you're sort of hooded. They put a bag over your head and drag you out onto the... We were hooded and dragged out to a sort of gorge.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, I realised it was the next few hours weren't going to be very, very easy.
But you know they're not going to kill you. They couldn't afford it.
Well, I reckoned that, I mean, exactly. Channel 4 couldn't really afford the payout, so I knew I wasn't going to die. But, you know, there were situations where if one's harness had failed or the wrong clip had gone in the wrong hook, you could have died. you know, because we were at height and we were doing a lot of really quite next level stuff.
Gosh, I bet you excelled. I'm going to watch this.
No, I certainly didn't excel. I was the oldest and the least fit recruit. But I gave it some of my best shots.
Well, in that case, all I can say, they must have been fighting fit, those other guys, because you are fit, aren't you?
No.
You look fit. You play tennis a lot. You look, you're not an
Do
ounce of spare flesh.
You.
You're muscle up. No, you are.
No, let's not discuss my physique.
Oh, well, anyway, I say you look pretty fit in terms of muscular. You know, not saying fat, but I think you do look like you are. I find your podcast fascinating because you say difficult women, but really you're meaning women with balls, aren't you? Basically,
yeah,
women who are ambitious.
That was taken by Katie Balls, of course, that title.
Yes. Yeah. So that is the thing. And I do find it extraordinary that if you want to sell a newspaper, you put a beautiful woman on the front page, don't you? That sells more copy than anything. And my mum collected silhouettes, you know, these funny little black portraits of people at one point that were done hundreds of years ago or whenever. And always the ones of women sold far more than the ones
really,
of men.
Really.
So in some ways we're valued. But then when we get a bit powerful, they come at you and knock you down, don't they? Because there's something that they don't like about
Who's
successful
they,
women. I think, generally, I think the media to extent. I mean,
I
when
not men in the media.
Well, I think when you see a very famous rich man has a girlfriend, then the media want to knock her down. And I wonder if it's because I don't know what it is, but they seem to. When they go for women, they tend to go for them big time in not a very nice way, I think. That's
like Meghan.
My perception of them. Like Meghan, yeah. I think the problem was she's smiling too much and they don't like her looking happy. And I think they do go for it. And when they start, it sells copy and then they go with it.
Yeah.
Would you agree there? I don't think that's wrong. That's my perception of lots of women who have been really hounded by the media.
Yes, I think that.
Unfairly.
I think the media, I think the newspaper industry is still fairly gendered. And if you're a female columnist, as I've been for many, many years, you're steered towards writing about other women. And the whole thing is a negative spiral because you're encouraged to write knocking copy about women. And then it looks like you're just bitching up another woman. And it's very unsisterly, but it makes easy reading,
right?
And it's a cheap way of filling a page. I mean, you right. must have been aware of the female columnists. They're known as the Wednesday witches.
Well,
no, I'm telling you because I've been one of them.
Yeah.
You know, basically you're not asked to write about Zelensky's Yalta summit in Kiev. You're asked to write about Kate Middleton's video, you know.
Right. And critical copy is always easiest to write.
Yeah, happiness writes white, etc.
Yeah. But you've been a judge on Woman's Hour Powerless, haven't you? And that's impressive. And also, something you hate in others, you say, is failure to grab life with the ball.
Oh, did I say that?
Like failure to grab life by the balls. And I love that.
Well, it's so short.
Yeah.
And it's always later than you think.
Yeah.
And I can't understand people who just don't take every opportunity and say yes, basically.
I think it takes a lot of confidence to do that, because you say that, but lots of things you grab by the balls, you know there's a chance they'll fail. Like, so when you stood to be the thing.
Yeah.
But actually, looking back at you failing to get in, you must have learnt so much.
I learnt a huge amount.
And so for that in itself, you're glad you did it. Wouldn't you say, if you could read your time again, you would still stand?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I would also say to everybody, you should put yourself forward for at least one vote, you know, position where people have to vote for you. You know, whether it's the parish council or you know, anything. It's put yourself out there. And women have to, if more women don't put themselves forward for things, we will never, ever progress. And we will still have a very unequal universe. I mean, we've gone backwards. in the course of this year alone. Look at what's happened in Afghanistan. Look what's happening in America, the rolling back of reproductive rights. Look what's happened here. Look what happened in the Provençal Hamlet, where a man has drugged his own wife. And a woman who was running in the marathon in the Olympics was set afire by her own boyfriend. We women have to get out there and kick ass. Otherwise, we are going to be continually tried to be, you know, they want to keep us down, Bunny. Yeah. We know that. Because it's the, you know, it's the traditional yeah. power structure. Yeah. They do not like it.
Mm, absolutely.
And that also underlines the misogyny in the media.
Yes.
And any time a woman sticks her head above the parapet, she has to have it blown off.
Yeah. No, I thoroughly endorse all of that. But I have to say, when you say grab life by the balls, it does take confidence to do that. And that is the thing that I think you should just see failure not always as a bad thing. I think is there anything you've grabbed by the balls and you regret it?
My principle is that I'm a pretty... Look, I'm not fishing at all, but I'm just as bad or good as any other woman, all right, at doing the things I do. And I think that if other women see me go on Question Time or Celebrity Best Home Cook or Celebrity SAS or putting myself up for election, knowing that I'm just pretty mediocre in terms of public speaking or writing or thinking, then it will encourage them to do it too.
And I think those are really good reasons. But I think whenever I see you, I never think of Rachel Johnson and Pretty Mediocre as in the same sentence, to be honest.
Well, that's very kind. I mean, I don't think you should...
No, but come on. Ashton House, Bryanston, St Paul's, Oxford, Classics, edited ISIS student paper, FT first female graduate at the paper. You know, it goes on
and
on.
Yeah, my career's been a downward trajectory ever since I left.
Oh, no, you've had children and family and you've combined it with a career and you've done pretty well. Now, I think you've been pretty meteoric, but you are comparing yourself, no doubt, to your siblings, and you know, well, that's life. But no, but I totally endorse what you say, and you should always try and do something you can't think you're going to do out of your comfort zone.
It's also such fun doing something, and even if
not
you
always,
fail,
not always, you have moments. Yes,
I mean, I can't think of anything I don't want to do really. I don't particularly want to climb mountains, because I think that would be a bit grueling and scary.
And you see pictures of people falling down glaciers.
I just don't want to. But I mean, I love all the sort of skiing, heli skiing, water skiing, you know, hiking, walking. I love all that. Sailing. I mean, I think, you know, put me outside and I'm happy.
Yes.
Not gardening though, Bunny.
Well, we'll come on to the gardening bit in a minute.
Oh, I'm garden resistant.
I did really enjoy your book, Rake's Progress. The things in that I had not realised, that it cost around 40k to be an MP. That
stand.
Was in 2019.
No,
to stand as an MP. So the whole cost of it is huge. So you're ruling out.
You have to
people.
Leave your job and basically spend a lot of money trying to get elected.
Yeah. You say you gave up a month of your life to do it, and it does need the ironclad confidence and hide of a rhino to do it. And I think, I'm sure it is. Having heard that, I thought, my God, that's one thing I certainly wouldn't put my name down for. And I loved the way that when you turned, you know, you weren't voted in, but then you had a T-shirt saying 46,600 voters cannot be wrong.
Do you know who got me that T-shirt?
Your brother?
No, Nick Ferrari.
Oh, really?
I should say that I'm a presenter on LBC.
Yes.
And I host this podcast called Global. Those are my two main gigs.
Yes.
Yeah. But so my fellow presenter, he's obviously a massively important presenter and I'm only a once a week. He got me that T-shirt because we were doing a Sky show together, which I had to step back from.
And while you were doing it.
And when I came back on the show, he gave me this T-shirt.
Oh, lovely. And did you wear it often?
No.
Framed it and put it in the loo.
I gave it away immediately.
Oh, I'm so disappointed, Rich. I thought you had thought it up, printed it, wore it.
No, he thought it up and gave it to me as a tease. And it said 46,000 people can be wrong.
Oh.
Not can't be wrong. So it was a diss.
Oh, right. Got it. Sorry.
Not at all.
But and your father, you said that he always says yes. He's always a glass full person, not even half full, a glass full person.
Yeah, he's amazing because he'd, whenever you see him, he says, "So what have I been doing?" And so you have to think, you've got to think, well, what am I going to say to my father when, you know, what have I been doing? So you've always got to come up with things like, oh, I've just been abseiling down the third largest dam in the Antipodes for Channel 4 or something. You've got to have something. Because he's always been doing something so amazing, like, oh, I've just been on the Great Wall of China on a motorbike. You know, that was his last thing.
Oh, my God, without a helmet.
Yeah.
Yes. Wow. And so what do you think gives you those energy levels? Do you think it's genes?
Genes.
It is genes.
Genes. Absolutely genes.
Right.
I don't really sit down during the day ever unless I have to write a piece. Does anybody? It's just my idea of hell being in an office sitting down.
Right.
You look nonplussed. Sometimes even when I'm presenting my 3-hour show, I sometimes stand up because I think, God, I've been sitting down for ages. I feel this kind of restlessness.
Yeah, you get that flat bottom syndrome, which I love.
I've got a flat bottom. I don't need syndrome. Yes.
No, I know what you mean by that. But one of the things that I thought was very unfairly awarded to you was the best bad sex fiction prize for your Shire Hell novel. I read it because I remember interviewing Alan Titchmarsh and he won it. And I think he won it rightly. But I have to say, I read your bit, and I thought
it
was
good. I
cracking.
Thought it was really well written.
Yeah, and a lot of bad sex is, I always think, is better written by men. They do write bad sex. I think women do it better.
Oh, well, I think the only reason I actually got that prize was because, one, they thought I would turn up to the award ceremony.
Which you did?
Which I did, and yes. Two, because...
Did they give you a good meal afterwards?
The joint winner that year was John Updike, and they knew he wouldn't turn up. So they wanted to give it to John Updike, but they knew he wouldn't turn up. So they gave it to me jointly, and I got the plaster foot, which is the prize.
Oh, right.
And then you just have a drinks party. It's great fun.
Oh, right. I bet. But just back to the bit when they followed you at the Lady magazine, and that I watched that television program hundreds of years ago, it seems now.
I know.
And you took that on. And what was interesting was you said that the amount of hours that they filmed, it always is like 600 hours filming for every minute on airtime. And it's all so...
And then they cut it together to make you look like a total bitch.
Exactly.
Yeah, well,
exactly.
That's what happened. It's fine. I don't care.
It was good viewing, and I don't think you came out as a total bitch, to be honest. I think you came out quite well.
Okay.
You don't think so?
Well, it was pretty. It was pretty out there. Yeah. I mean, the thing is that I can't either play to the cameras or pretend to be anybody else. Life's far too short. So what you see is what you get. And I never, you know, I don't try and charm people. Ivo says I'm very rude. We're about to talk to him. You can ask him.
Ah.
He says I'm famously rude. So if the TV cameras are on, it doesn't make any difference. I'll still be famously rude.
Yeah, that's good. So that filter thing is you don't care, or that's just how you are and you can't curb it.
It's what I'm like in real life. Weirdly, when I'm behind the mic at LBC, I'm actually quite nice. But I think my family say it's not the real me. You know, they say, why are you so nice to callers? And I don't know. I just go into I love my callers mode. So I'm not going to like be so rude to them that they don't ring again. It's weird. But I think I have an LBC persona and a television persona and a real persona, maybe. Maybe I've just contradicted myself, but I don't know.
I would say they're all pretty similar, really.
Good.
Do you think?
Good.
I think they
That's
are.
That's a result. That's what I wanted to hear.
I mean, I find the difference between when you're at people at work and you're at home, you're two completely different people. I think everybody is, aren't you? And I think you just behave differently in different situations, and I don't think it would be any more than that. But I do think you come across as how you are, which is always refreshingly
nice. For example, in the back
nice.
Of your car saying, you're the terrible driver and have you got COVID? That was like classic. Instead of thinking I've got to be quiet and very
No, but to be honest, I was aware. Poor Rachel insisted. Just explain to the listeners here, in case they think I am a bad driver. I took my test 4 times before I got it, and when we passed, was a celebratory burning of the number plates, which about 200 people attended. But I was throwing it round the corners, and I have to admit, I was not quite on the ball.
No,
because
you were fine. I'm just incredibly rude, Bunny.
No, but I did say to you, I'm sorry, Rachel, are you okay in the back? Because I suddenly saw this head zooming across the back of the car from side to side. And I thought I might have knocked her out. And I did say, God, I'm a dreadful driver. Are you okay? And
but
you
I insisted in sitting at the back because you coughed throughout our podcast.
I'm sorry. And you thought I have COVID. I hope to God I haven't.
Let's hope you
don't. But this is Kathy Cluxton's fault, who we were recording with Gardener's Question Time a couple of days back. But she didn't say she had it. We had this lurgy.
Nobody admits it anymore.
I think it's a little cough,
yeah,
frankly.
No, it's
that's
fine.
What I'm hoping.
A little COVID's fine.
Anyway, we're in your lovely garden here, and this is a gardening podcast. And obviously, I've brought you on because of your green credentials.
No, lack of.
And I would like Ivo. Is Ivo there?
Can you get Ivo?
The lovely Ivo Dorney, your husband, and he's going to come. Who gardens with you?
No, I don't garden, Bunny.
Married way.
We can't push out fake news like this. I avoid.
They'll be having you on Gardener's Question Time as a guest panelist.
If I gardened, he'd make me do all the work. This is also a really good way for him to take exercise, which he doesn't do, and get involved in something. I have too much on. I'm
right.
So happy to leave it to him.
Yes.
He loves it. He's learning. It's really good for him.
Yes.
Gives him great pleasure. And it's his late onset discovery of gardening has been a game changer. He loves being in the country.
Mm.
And, I grew up on this farm where he gardens and nobody had a garden there.
Yes.
We actually had a gardener called Sydney. So we had a vegetable garden, a kitchen garden. And a tiny strip at the front of the longhouse.
Yes.
But, farmers don't have gardens.
No, I come on.
And here he comes.
So just for everyone listening, if they're confused with the setup, I'm with Ivo Dorney, who's Rachel's lovely husband here and is the gardener in the household. And Rachel was just saying that she likes you to get into gardening. She really likes you to have something.
She likes me out of the house.
I've got a problem with my husband because he's recently retired and it's finding something for him to do, but I could not persuade him to garden because, but do you like gardening on your own or would you like Rachel to garden with you?
I wouldn't mind her doing some weeding as she spends her whole time cleaning up the house.
I'm too busy cleaning up after you to weed.
I don't see why she shouldn't help by
cleaning
up the garden.
Cleaning surfaces and after you've made bagels and left your Nicorette gum everywhere.
But so
nervous
Rachel,
after.
We've just heard Rachel saying that she grew up on Exmoor Longhouse. No electricity, cold. It's an outdoor idyllic life, though, in a way, would you say?
It was. I mean, we didn't have TV, let alone electricity. We had tilly lamps. And actually, we did have a generator, but my grandfather would turn it off when he went to bed, which is usually when he got back from the pub in the morning. And yeah, it was very, very primitive. It was one bathroom, tilly lamps, baby lambs by the Rayburn, that kind of kitchen.
Mm, very nice.
When I first went to stay with them, you had to try and not be the last to go to bed, because if you were the last to go to bed, you had to run across the farmyard, turn off the generator and all the lights went off and you had to fumble your way in pitch darkness back to the house where you'd come from.
As the engine thing kept whirring, the machine was in a dark engine shed, pitch black, with the thing still going like that. And then you worried about your arm getting stuck inside it.
But this very different from where we are now, because we're in this beautiful garden. I have to say, I've never been in a London garden with such a big area of greenery.
It's Rus in Urbe.
Absolutely,
really is.
It is. So, but on this little private balcony, we're up high with two olive trees, lovely wicker outdoor furniture. We're overhung by, it looks like, a sort of almond tree. Does it actually fruit? The almond?
Yes.
The squirrels love it.
The squirrels come and take them all.
Yep.
Right. And then we've got some window boxes behind me.
Herb garden. Oh, that's the herb. But this is our neighbour's herb garden.
Oh, I see, you share it.
Well, and I take it and they look after it. That's my principle.
And then below us is another tiny little private garden with big olive trees. And you look after all this?
No, he doesn't. I look after this garden. He looks after Somerset.
What Rachel means is she employs a man to come in and cut things in this garden.
That's true. Ferdy. Shout out to Ferdy.
Oh, right. So why don't you, Ivan? Why don't you cut things?
I don't think this garden's very promising. It's just so in the shade. And
we're sitting here, and I'm honestly, I'm thinking, why didn't I put my factor 90 on today? I'm blitzed.
Yes, well, I suppose we could have pots up here. But then I am more of the time in the country.
Right.
And I know that Rachel wouldn't look after them, so I don't think there's much point. I'm going to put all my efforts into the country, where I have about a foot and a half of border all round the front of a old farmhouse, and it's only about, I'd say, 40 feet of border, and then behind it a sort of side of a trained side of a hillside which has a few shrubs in it and a few apple trees and a pear and a plum and various other trees in it. Liquid amber and things that I've put in.
Oh, really? That's becoming quite popular, isn't it?
But I do like colour. I'm only been a gardener for about 3 years, and so I, of course, listen religiously to Gardener's Question Time.
And do you think we always get it right, or do you disagree sometimes?
I don't feel I have the authority to disagree with anything. No, I'm lapping it all up.
I think that's something, the sooner you learn that, the better in gardening, is that there's not one way, there's 6 million ways. So we might go through one or two or three different ways to do something, but you might well find a better way for you, because you'll be gardening in totally unique situation where you are, quite different from the guy next door, different aspect. And you can push things to the limit in gardening and often get away with it. So don't be, you know, it's nice to listen to other people talking about it and hearing how they do it, but it doesn't mean to say that you can't find a yet better way, I think.
Yeah. Well, as I say, I'm very, very new to it all, so I spend a lot of time listening to you, and I also I use YouTube a lot to find out what I should be doing to my various plants and when they should be planted and when they should be watered and all those sort of questions, and whether they can be pruned or whether they shouldn't be pruned, and all those sorts of questions.
And so in 10 years time, if I came and visited your
tiny plot,
but then you said your hillside, up the hillside bit, that sounds more expansive.
Well, that's more it'd be romantic to call it a shrubbery, but I'm beginning to put in some little shrubs there, which I rather like.
Right.
But again, you know, I'm very bad at knowing what to buy, because we're 800 foot where we are. And the garden centres which I go to, there's actually a very good one near us, a sort of independent garden centre, and he's a very nice man, but he keeps saying, oh, well, you're too high up
is
for
that
this.
Cove,
yeah. And he's, you know, he's quite good at advising me what I can do, but when I beg him to come out and come and have a look, he says he's too busy, so I'm really experimenting all the time, and lots of things I plant seem to die pretty quickly.
What failures have you had?
Goodness me, I'm trying to think. There have been so many.
What about your vegetable garden?
Well, my vegetable garden was fine while I was tending it, and then I stopped tending it, and it grew over very, very quickly. My strawberries don't seem to do very well. I've got them netted.
How many years have your strawberry plants been in?
I put in new plants this year, and they started producing nice green strawberries, and then they just sort of faded and disappeared.
Was it the birds or the rain?
I think it was more the rain than birds, because they were netted. I have raspberries, and I've got summer raspberries and autumn raspberries, but I think they're a bit unruly and out of control now, and I probably need to cut them right back. But again, you see, to know what to do, I will probably have to refer to some online person. Or I've got some rather wonderful Victorian gardening books, which I've discovered. We have a wonderful local secondhand bookshop, which has sort of fabulous books from ancient days, which seem very authoritative about what to do.
The only thing is that things change quite a lot with time, and so much research has come in, you know, like no dig and things like that. So although I think they're lovely to look at, I think the information probably on YouTube, someone who a raspberry grower is better. But really, with the autumn one, just cut them to the ground in sort of January, and need to do that to stop them becoming out of control, really. And they are much easier, I think people find, than the summer ones.
Yeah. I tried no dig. It was a complete disaster, actually, because all the weeds seem to get through anyway.
Well, that's because probably you've got a weed seed burden in the soil, and so you need to kill off the annual weeds as they come up, or pull them up as they come. But I tell you, it will work, but you need to apply a mulch to stop all those weed seeds germinating. Did you do that?
I'm trying to remember, but I put down a lot of paper and a lot of cardboard on top of it, and then put the soil on the top of the cardboard.
Oh, so things blew in. You've probably got seeds blowing in from everywhere, yes, and they germinate in the soil. So in that case, you need to keep
our hedges. Our hedges are very wild, and and everything is pretty out of control where we are.
So obviously, if you're putting soil on and you've got weeds flying in, you've got to keep pulling them out. Otherwise, with no dig, or any type of gardening, otherwise they will just. Yeah. They say is it 1 year's weeding is a 10 years. 1 year seeding is 10 years weeding or something, because the massive seed burden you get. But I mean, I do find, since I've got a netted cage for my brassicas now, that's changed my life. Because I've got lovely big cabbages, and Brussels sprouts aren't totally mullered by the cabbage white butterflies and things. So, and a polytunnel, it would be like gardening for the south of France.
We've got huge, what are they called?
Slugs?
Slug problems as well. Mm. Massive amount of slugs everywhere. But I've learned that the beer slug trap is an extremely efficient thing, actually.
Yeah, they are quite good, but they stumble on them and fall into them, don't they? But, I mean, I do, I'm afraid, use the ferric phosphate slug pellets
those little bright blue pellets.
The bright blue is a colourant to deter the birds. It's not the active ingredient. But they are approved by some organic people, and I think there are thousands of slugs all around me, so if I keep them off my lettuces and my cabbages, I think fair dues on that 10 square metres or whatever. Because I think this year has been exceptionally bad.
For slugs.
And this, because of the wet conditions, and this is the year the RHS chose to say we will welcome them and not call them pests, but garden visitors. And the slugs all stood and said hooray and came into our garden. So this year has been impossible, very difficult. But with my pellets, I'm okay. And the other thing is, I do have a little greenhouse, and I think you should put that on your Christmas list from Rachel, because I grow all my vegetable plants in little plug plants in the greenhouse before I put them out, and I wait till they're quite big stonking plants, because then they can withstand a bit of slug nibbling. And if you put them out when they're young and vulnerable, they will go overnight.
Get a greenhouse. I'm all in favour of it.
Well, I have been thinking about getting a greenhouse, but that I spent a lot of time sort of greenhouse shopping and brochures and thinking, ooh, it'd be so nice to have the Hartley Botanic, not the Rhino.
and realise
that there's a sort of £10,000 difference in price and stuff, and then sort of back off and decide not to get anything because I'm too mean.
Yeah, well, I mean, mine are just homemade greenhouses from old windows and built up on a wall, like you would have a stone wall to match your barn or your house. And then, and it costs, like, one was £1,000 and one was 2000.
I've got an idea. Why don't you build a greenhouse on the east end of our house?
Well, that's an interesting thought. What would you feel about a greenhouse that was half the day in the shade?
Well, I've got one greenhouse facing north, and I got one greenhouse which is just on its own. And on the one that's facing north against a 4 meter high stone wall, I still grow tomatoes and peppers and things. So I think it's fine, because, I mean, this period's got so bright recently, hasn't it? And you'll be out there otherwise putting shade netting everywhere. So I think that's your Christmas thing. I think you'll get a chair in there for Rachel so she can come and supervise you and listen, order you around if she wants to. And she might get the bug, you never know. And I think if you do it, try and do it as regularly as possible. I try and get out there, even if it's for 5 minutes every day. So the shadow of the garden is the best fertiliser, and I sincerely believe that. It just means that you're watching them. You just watch that the slugs aren't coming. You just watch when something needs cutting, and you buy into it. You look after them, basically, regularly, and you don't abandon them for months on end and then come back when the weather's fine.
Could we get a carpenter just come and knock up a glazed area off the side of the house?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I mean, I don't know if your house is listed or whatever.
It's not.
It's not. Well, I mean, I honestly think that is good. And if you, Emma Bridgewater has made these sort of lovely verandas on her house with one side open and the house wall and two sides. And it's a moderated environment, but you could do that. And you can make it look good. You, having worked for the National Trust, will, you know, you won't put some a gopher up there. You'll do it with local stone and paint it to match in with your house. But just to go back on, so this garden I'm so impressed with. So this tiny little balcony above and below, double decker, then this massive communal space with exercise things for you. It must be almost half an acre. I mean, it's extraordinary.
No, big. We think it's bigger.
You think it's bigger? I can well believe it. I would not know I'm in London.
And an acre is two tennis courts, isn't it?
Ah, God, well, then it's definitely there. Two tennis courts or three.
Oh, it can be more like five tennis courts.
Yeah, I think
would
it's.
Say.
I thought it was 4 or 5 acres. I don't know. Mm. But anyway, we're incredibly lucky.
So you've got. It's nice because you've got the conviviality, so you get to know your neighbours here.
You can't help it.
Yeah, and you've got exercise space. You had. What was the race you had?
It was the dog race.
We had a garden sports day every. We have a garden sports day every year.
For the children, but there's always a dog's race.
And there's a mummies and daddies race, and then there's a dog's race.
Oh my God, competing with you, Rachel. Did you win?
Ziggy won. My dog won. I didn't. But it was abandoned a couple of years ago because one dog mauled another very badly, or mauled a child. But I insisted it had to return this year because I knew Ziggy. It was Ziggy's year.
This is quite different, though, from the garden at Chequers. Now, everybody is fascinated by Chequers. But I think the story of how Chequers came to be given to use by the prime ministers is fascinating, don't you? Can you just run us through that, Ivy?
Well, I don't think I know very much about it, but it was some grandee, wasn't it?
Arthur Lee.
Yes, who gave it to the nation on the understanding only that the prime minister would...
For the rest and recreation. The prime ministers.
Throughout. And I can't remember when that was. Was that Asquith? Was his first prime minister there? I can't remember. It was somewhere around the turn of the century, I think.
Lloyd George.
It was Lloyd George.
Yes. And Carol Thatcher compared it to a boutique hotel. But the gardens, they got Henry Tipping in, who'd worked with Jekyll and Lutyens and created wall gardens. And it sounds lovely. And it's called Chequers after Sorbus torbinalis, which is a rather unknown native sorbus tree. And apparently there's a national collection of unusual box there in the wood.
Well, you know much more about it than I do, Bunny. I'm not sure about that. We did before that, thanks to Rachel's rather high-achieving brother, go to Chevening, and that had the most wonderful... maize in it, and lovely trees.
Chevening's the Foreign Secretary's residence.
Which is a similar arrangement to Chequers. It was given by some wealthy aristocrat for the use of the Foreign Secretary.
And tell me about the Chevening garden.
Well, it's more of a park, really. It's got lovely sort of large walks, and it's surrounded by extremely mature trees. There's a lovely lake with a little boat you can row out on it. And I thought it had rather more charm than Chequers, which is nice, but is slightly boxed in by roads and things of that kind.
Mm. Sweetheart, Chequers is... They're both magical. I mean, yeah. Chequers, you're in this... The shade of this escarpment in the Chilterns. Chevening feels more private, yes, because you don't have people patrolling with submachine guns and CCTV and sort of that kind of thing.
Well, you know, I mean, you've been many times. I only went once.
The Chequers parterre is very famous, the front of the house.
Yeah.
Which is beautifully done. Cool. Yeah.
Not Henry Tipping, who worked with Jekyll.
Maybe.
It could have been.
Yeah. But
I was right to mention the maze in Chevening. I mean, if you get in there, you will not get out. I mean, it's the great after dinner or after lunch game, you know, let's go into the maze, and then, you know, you don't see the you won't see Zelensky for hours.
Good ploy. Yeah. Yes, I wonder if it was planted for that purpose. I doubt it. But it's Wood Pastures, the Parkland, is it? Was it Capability Brown?
I think it is, and there's a shoot as well at Chevening. Are you talking Chevening or Chequers?
Chevening. When you describe the Wood Pastures with the ancient trees, typical,
yes,
sort of capability.
It's a marvellous sort of vista at the top with a sort of arch through it. You know, so it's very kind of beautifully organised and... you know, splendid bit of kind of the Weald, I suppose, isn't it? It's just south Kent, just south of the.
It's an extraordinary layout. You can be in the house at Chevening and you look out of a sort of second floor window, and you look straight over the
sort of
over the drive. And I think there's a it's a huge round
carriage drive,
and then straight up and all the way up, straight up, you see this vantage point. This. Where you can do a sort of circular walk and stand there and look straight down again, and they've cut through the woodland. It's one of those. What do you call that?
Vista. It sounds like
extraordinary.
That sounds like a Capability Brown, or maybe him or one of his mates or follower-ons from that. That's a typical sort of ploy. So your work at the National Trust. So you.
It was quite a long time ago. I was first communications director, and then I got slightly bored of doing that because at that time. The National Trust was having nothing but good publicity, not thanks to me, but just thanks to the good work it was doing. And so I changed over to become London director because we'd never really attempted to get into London because London property is obviously so expensive and everything else. And I set my own brief, which was to try and make the National Trust relevant in London without having any properties here. So we had... we did a lot of slightly stunty things, which went down extremely well with the public, actually. Like, we opened the Big Brother House studio to the public for a weekend, saying National Trust houses, if people want to see them because of what they represent in terms of decoration and style and everything else, but also because of their history and because what they lent to the history of the nation. And my argument was, you may not like Big Brother, the programme, or the look of the house, but the fact is it was a historic moment in British television because it was the first serious reality TV show in which ordinary members of the public were the stars. And even the Daily Telegraph, which has a long tradition of hostility to the National Trust on the grounds that it thinks it's far too woke, had to confess that this was a good argument. Anyway, we had tens of thousands of people apply to go round.
What?
I think we got 500 of them round the property in the end. And we did other things. We had a tour of Soho, which was downloadable to your phone and would tell you the history of post-war Soho and all its seediness, but also its culture and its art and its music and all those things. So we had quite a lot of fun in London. Ham House, of course, is... We do have one or two properties in London. Ham House at Richmond is a wonderful house with a wonderful garden, which you probably know.
Oh, beautiful. So many walled gardens with lovely old red bricks.
Yes, and extraordinarily old house, which looks quite modern, but is actually early 17th century, I think.
Austerly? Austerly got a good
also garden? Is National Trust, which is marvellous, which very few people know about, really. It's much used by people who live there, very close to Heathrow Airport. And wonderful, wonderful, huge, extensive parkland. The M4 drives right round the edge of it.
And very good farm shop.
Very good farm shop, lovely lake, and an extraordinary house. And then there are little places like... there's a wonderful Tudor house in the middle of Hackney, which is almost like Wolf Hall, as in Wolf Hall. It was owned by a great mate of Henry VIII, who lived it up there. And so there are wonderful places. There's also the garden you must love, and I'm trying to remember its name now, in Hampstead. There's a great house there with a fabulous garden whose name I cannot for the moment remember. So that there are things, but not a lot of them. Mm. But we also opened things which people hadn't ever seen before. So we again, rather like the Big Brother house, we opened a council flat in the Balfron Tower, which is the famous Trellick Tower's older brother, which is in East London. And it was built by a famous Hungarian architect called Goldfinger, after whom Goldfinger in the Bond books was named. And it was a very good example of post-war modernism. And we opened that to the public. And again, a whole new audience, which wouldn't usually go near the National Trust, but young people interested in modern brutalist architecture all came traipsing around the house. Mm. So we had quite a lot of fun doing different things.
That's a brilliant idea. I mean, I think it is amazing when you go to other countries like France and Italy and you see the wonderful old buildings, but they have no one to help them. Even Southern Ireland, they've got so many fabulous properties just falling to bits, and there's no one that can help them with them. And it's just a shame. Yeah. So, and is the audience younger now than the National Trust? What would be the average age of a National Trust guy?
Goodness knows. I always say you come to the National Trust three times in your life. Once when you're a six-year-old child, dragged there by your grandparents. Mm. The next time when you're the owner of a six-year-old child and you're dragging your six-year-old child there. And the final time is when you're the grandparent taking your six-year-old child around.
But tell Bunny what the children always used to say.
Oh, yes. When I forced my wife, who is very uncultured, and my children round, they always used to say, "Bring on the boring house," as we drove up the drive.
Or another boring house.
No, I can't believe it.
There they were, these magnificent places, which hundreds of years of loving and nurturing had brought to the great British public, and my family were completely unappreciated.
I love seeing houses now.
But Rachel,
Hatton House is the house in Hampstead. Do you know it?
I don't think I do.
Garden, absolutely superb walled garden. Quite beautiful. You should go and see.
Oh, go and have a look. But Rachel, the Big Brother garden. What did you think of the big? Because when I watched the
garden,
first,
there was some plasticky fake grass and a hot tub, not hot tub for health and safety, and a kind of pergola where we all smoked ourselves stupid and drank ourselves stupid in order to get through the day. And that was it. There was no actual garden.
I just remember seeing maybe one of the first few, when everybody watched it with anyone in it. And it was like, then it was like state of the art, wasn't it? It was the sun loungers, the hot tub. Then they had the real hot tub. And I think everyone thought, wow, and sort of almost aspired to that sort of outdoor living. But similar to it, it probably hasn't changed a lot now, has it?
When Big Brother started, I looked into the history of this because we were writing the pamphlet for it. And when Big Brother started, it was actually full of really good sort of modern Danish Scandinavian furniture and really absolutely first in class sort of late modern sort of 60s, 70s furniture and stuff like that. And then as the programme went on, it got more and more sort of satirical and ironic. So the thing got more and more sort of extreme and crazy, which the public, I think, loved. And it was quite fun. We did go round it together at one point after Rachel had been thrown out. And the children, they loved going to the Big Brother house.
Yeah, I think most children would adore that. I'd like that too. But anyway, no, that's lovely. Thank you both very much for being on the podcast. I'm deeply envious of this beautiful big green space that you can enjoy. It's just, I can literally just look out and all I see is acres of green. Unbelievable. I bring all my guests a little present, and I bought you some Verbena Bampton. Now, the reason I bought Verbena Bampton is because it's a very new plant, but it is amazing. I put it in some containers at home, and it grows about 600 mil, 2 foot high, and I water them maybe twice the entire summer, and they still grow.
Oh, wow.
And they're hardy, and they'll flower from sort of June right the way through to Christmas. They'll seed. I know you, Rachel, as soon as you get them, you'll be propagating them up and make them into 1,000 little cuttings with your very green fingers, ready to go into your new greenhouse to grow on when you get it for your Christmas present. But I hope you enjoy them. I think they're a brilliant plant, but thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Very nice to meet you finally after years listening to you on the radio.
Thank you. I feel very old now. Thank you.